think we have about 5 minutes for questions. Do we have about
10?
5, 10? 10, yeah. So please head on up to the microphone. Kara, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Kara Johnson. I worked for many years as a director of character education at a school for girls. I've observed recently a phenomenon that seems to be reported on in the business section of newspapers, reflecting on the generation of employees that is now being dealt with in the business world, and that the seems to me the regular recommendation is for management to learn to adapt to the style of these employees so that they are satisfied and they don't leave and they don't seem to care. And it seems to be, to me, I'm not sure if I'm right on this, but almost fostering a welfare mentality towards the employees, that unless we make things good for them, they'll go elsewhere. And I sort of think, well, maybe they should go elsewhere. But do you have any thoughts on this as sort of the societal and even economic consequences of that generation, which I'm not even sure what they're calling it now, coming into the workforce and not having a second nature that's been trained in the home, but now seems to be almost that if the workplace doesn't impose it, well, it's out of the question that the workplace imposes that, it seems.
Well, I read an article on exactly this point. I can't remember what newspaper it was in, but it was an article about the attitudes of new workers entering the workforce, young people. And I thought the headline on this article summed it up. The headline was, "Hey dude, where's my office?" you know what? I actually think that one of the most important things that people learn when they go into the workplace is that they don't bring their worth with them. They have to establish it through their productive effort. This is what employers look for. You know, employers are not there to accommodate workers. Workers are there to offer value to employers. That's the proposition. Now, of course, if the young people have been raised in a society in which they have never experienced the notion that they must come back to my argument in the talk, that they must actually be able to put restraints on what they want in order to successfully cooperate with others, you know, they are going to deeply damage their worth to employers, amongst other things. So I actually think this is a manifestation of all the things that I've been talking about. Yes, absolutely. John.
Good morning. Thanks for a fantastic presentation. I think most libertarians and social conservatives would be quite united on the idea of certain public policies of, say, welfare reform, so that the government stops undermining the family. I'm wondering if you have any comments, and perhaps it's covered in your book, on what role the state could have or should have, if any, in buttressing the family in terms of issues such as pornography and prostitution and the definition of marriage, and if you have any comments on those issues as they pertain to the relationship between state and family and the state's role in upholding and promoting the family.
Sure, thank you. I don't say this to promote the book, but get the book from the library. I don't care whether you buy it or not. There's actually... There's Roy. Sorry to disillusion you. There's no money in publishing in Canada. And besides which, I'm very happy to tell you that both hard copy printings of the book have sold out. You can't get it in the warehouse anymore. There's still a few copies in the stores. They're bringing the paperback version out 6 months early because it's a national bestseller. So. All of that simply to say, John, that it would be too long and complicated for me to get into. I've got a whole chapter in there about what I think we need to do. Let me just pick one example. I actually think that, and this is something that actually Andrea helped me out with when I was writing the book. Andrea read the family chapter and gave me lots of good information and pointers, and I make use of some of the terrific work of the Institute for Marriage and Family Canada, in the book. The book is quite concerned with demographics and the birth dearth, or you know, the decline of fertility and so on. And one of the things that really struck me was the extent to which, I mean, in one sense, you know, people should have the number of kids they want. I have no interest in having people have more children than they want. But the irony is that it's very clear from the data that actually Canadians, and especially Canadian women, want more children than they're having. And that's a different problem. I mean, that suggests to me that there's, amongst other things, that there are probably some incentive issues that we have to deal with, so that we're not creating, through public policy, the conditions in which people actually have fewer children than they want. And I have quite a long discussion in the book about the issues for women in particular around having children in a set of institutional circumstances where marriage is not dependable, or to put it another way, where divorce is very easy. And if you think about it, I'm summarizing terribly here, but never mind. The argument I make in the book is that women faced with the simple reality that if marriage breaks down, the likelihood that they are going to have to look after the children, and they are going to be the ones who are going to live in low income and all those other things, they look at that as a risk management proposition, as any rational person would. What's the best way to manage that risk? The best way to manage that risk is to acquire a career and to spend a long time working before you have children. Because the one thing that cannot be taken away from you, every, you know, household assets, homes, retirement funds, incomes can all be divided. Your career cannot be divided. It is yours. It is the one thing unambiguously that you take away. And so the argument I make in the book is that in an era of easy divorce in the context of children, that women have a huge economic incentive to work more than they say they want to and to have fewer children. And so I have some suggestions about marriage reform and so on that are relevant. So, but that's just one example. There's lots of other things that we should... I hope people will have a look in the book. Sorry.
Hi there, thanks a lot for your talk. It seems to me that there's a bit of, I guess, a recognition by the secular left that there's a problem with passing on character and values to young people, which is why we're seeing an increasing push towards character education in schools, and also me being subjected to terrible ethics classes in university. How do we respond to these kind of trends? Why are they insufficient in terms of replacing the traditional family?
Sorry, what was the last part of the question?
Why are they, you know, how can we show that they're insufficient in terms of replacing the role taken by the traditional family?
Well, I don't know. You know, ethics classes at university seems to me like asking a cult to babysit your children. That's only slightly unfair. Well, look, if you think back to my talk, I mean, there are many reasons. But let me... For me, everything goes back to Aristotle, sorry. You know, Aristotle says, essentially, that by the time you're, I don't think he picks an age, but by the time you're an adult, your character is largely formed. You know, why is it that people who marry each other thinking they'll change each other are so often so bitterly disappointed? And so this is exactly why, Aristotle said, exactly why character must be formed in the home when children are small, because that's when these characters and behaviors are inculcated. You know, if you don't get inculcated with the right values when you're a child, it doesn't create a vacuum that can then be filled later by ethics lectures at university. The space is filled by something else when you're a child. And, you know, by the time it's formed, it's not set in stone, but it's not totally malleable either. And it actually requires a huge effort of will to reshape second nature by the time you become an adult. And the notion that you can, through rational argument, change these fundamental aspects of your character, many of which are not reached by rationality, is a complete inversion of, in my view, what we know about how human beings are created.
I'll take the last two questions here.
I'll refrain from commenting on the supreme value of Calvinism, and instead, offer instead of a question, but a comment and a suggestion for the folks at IMFMC, and actually for you, Brian. One of the largest contributions of your book, from my perspective, is that public policy is, in the next 15, 20 years, going to be made in a world of labor shortage rather than labor surplus. I see this as a very good thing for economic policy, but I'm worried about it in terms of family policy, because in a world of labor shortage, there's an encouragement to do some of the things you talked about earlier and encourage women to maybe spend more time in the labor force than they want to. And so my comment is merely that we do at IMFC, and you, and I know your think tank, and continue the work you're doing, that we think seriously about what policy to help the family looks like in a world with labor shortage. And so I'll leave that as a comment, a suggestion, because I think you opened my eyes, certainly, to this changing reality, and it's demographically driven, but I don't think anyone's thinking about these things, and if IMFC can get ahead of the curve on that, they will do a massive contribution to public policy in Canada.
Here, here.
That was a fast question. Just real quickly, the I mean, I don't think it's a surprise to anybody that politics is largely a symbolic enterprise. And while we were seriously a monarchy, we had in the royal family a kind of, this is not a monarchist rant, by the way, while we had in the royal family a certain kind of public, visible, authoritative symbolism of family life.
Yeah.
And the current family state of the royal family leaves a lot to be desired. But, I mean, I guess my question is, where is there a visible, authoritative, or where can we find a visible, authoritative locus for family loyalty? I mean, there's no level of government that represents family.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I guess the if I understand the question correctly, you'll tell me if I've got it wrong. I mean, there certainly was an extent to which the royal family did play, I think it's less true now, did play the role of symbolizing what, not just the majesty of the state, but the majesty of other institutions, including the family. And it was a symbolic representation of the deep sources of the dynamism of British society and colonial society. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So if the question is, you know, where is the symbolic equivalent today? I don't know, Britney Spears? I don't know. you see, that's part of the problem. You see, if I can just take 1 second, you know, I actually think that celebrity is very important here. If you read, say, you know, Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, he actually talks quite a lot about, well, some of you, if you read that book, you'll remember that he talks about smoking, for example. He says, you know, what do we know about why kids smoke? And he said, a lot of people who are trying to get kids to stop smoking do so on the premise that they think, the reason kids smoke is because it's cool to smoke. He said, nope. This is completely incorrect. The reason kids smoke is because cool people smoke. Completely different. Completely different. He talked, I think he uses this expression, I've certainly come to think about it this way. He used the expression, I think, that they're permission givers. And this is one of the roles that celebrities play in life. Is it, you know, why is it that, you know, when Farrah Fawcett Major, sorry, as a very old reference. She just died the other day or something, I think. But, you know, back when I was a kid, Farrah Fawcett Major got a new hairdo, and, you know, 3 weeks later, everybody had that hairdo, right? I mean, that's permission giving at work. And so I don't think anybody should underestimate the value of these symbolic representations. Where can we find that symbolic representation? I mean, there are lots of sources where one could find it, but I think the issue is, how do we make them credible to a large swath of society that doesn't already subscribe to them? I think that's perhaps the issue. And I don't know what the answer is to that, but it's a very, very good question for us to think about.
Thank you very much, Brian. I will present you with this book. Thank you for your time this morning. I always love when Brian... Oh, yeah, that's fun.